You found it all right.
Yeah.
But you found it all right, I see. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll get started with our 201 group and then pick up 107 immediately following this. I'd like to start by introducing Dr. Goals, if he could identify his first name and affiliation, and
University of Oregon.
Then introduce our others from his left.
Okay, this is Larry Haskin, University of Wisconsin, Madison, and George Morrison, Ithaca, Cornell University of Ithaca. And then Bill Eamon, professor of chemistry at the University of Kentucky, John Wasson at UCLA, and sitting at the end is John Philpotts of Goddard Space Flight Center in Washington.
I think what we would like to do at this point, Dr. Goals, is have each member of your panel describe in about 2 minutes their paper this morning, then we'll open it for questions from members of the press.
You mean we get 2 extra minutes in addition to the 15 we just used upstairs? Larry, why don't you start?
Different audience.
Well, in our case, we've been examining the trace constituents of the lunar materials, which are known as rare earth elements. We find are a very coherent chemical group on the earth, quite difficult to separate from each other. We find that certain natural processes involved in the formation of igneous rocks do change the abundance patterns of these elements by taking some of the elements preferentially into certain phases and leaving the rest behind. And in our paper, we were examining the difficulties presented in using the kinds of processes which go on in silicate liquids as they cool or as they are formed by partial melting of solid material to produce the changes in ratio of two of these rare earth elements, samarium and europium. We concluded that with the kinds of data we have strictly from terrestrial materials, we would have to favor a partial melting origin, that is, that the lunar samples represent frozen liquids which were generated by partial melting of previously existing material, as opposed to having them represent residual liquids after much crystalline material had frozen out. But we must qualify this by pointing out that we don't know the appropriate values for the parameters for melts on the lunar surface, which may be quite different from those we deal with terrestrially.
Well, our approach was a multi-element analysis of various lunar samples. I would venture to guess, I think, that we have perhaps the most complete analysis. We were able to determine 68 elements in each one of the samples that we received. These elements represent the majors, the minors, and the trace elements. And we have analyzed representatives, rocks representative of the various textural groups as well as the lunar soil. And from this overall survey type of approach, we come to the conclusion that chemically or elementally, the samples are similar at the 2 sigma level of significance. If one tries to probe a little deeper to find certain differences, we do find that the various rocks group themselves into 2 groups, but this is unexplainable at the present time. We then compared with this fingerprint approach the comparison of the lunar samples to various other materials, solar abundances, meteoritic abundances, basalts, terrestrial material, and so forth, and came up with the obvious situation that of all the materials, the lunar materials approximate the basaltic achondrites and the basalts. The correlation is pretty good there, but there are definitely differences with regard to the trace element behavior. And so all we can say is that while the lunar samples on the average resemble the basalt and the basaltic achondrites, there are differences indicating a distinct geochemical history of its own. One other thing I might mention, which I could not present at the paper, was the fact that we did have some surface analyses of the lunar soil. This was using Auger spectroscopy, and at the top 2 to 4 atomic layers of the surface of the soil, the major elements determined were calcium, oxygen, and titanium. And the significance of this, of course, is still to be explained. But no iron was found on this top layer.
Nope. In contrast to Dr. Morrison, we were concerned with determining the abundances of only 3 elements, silicon, oxygen, and aluminum. However, we did have the advantage of a very large set, 27 lunar rocks, and we analyzed also 3 aliquots of lunar soil. So we got a rather good profile of these 3 major elements across the lunar materials that were collected by the Apollo 11 mission. Technique we used was a non-destructive technique, activation analysis. We found that the various rock types and soil did not differ appreciably in their silicon and oxygen content, but the various rock types were quite different with respect to their aluminum content, and in fact so different that one could virtually classify them by the aluminum content. We also found that the lunar rocks were somewhat depleted in oxygen as compared to comparable terrestrial rocks. The oxygen abundances were lower than in comparable terrestrial basalts and so on. From the differences on aluminum, it seems pretty obvious, as was pointed out in a number of papers today, that the lunar soil cannot be just a simple mixture of type A and B rocks, but must also have some other components. To explain the aluminum abundance in the soil, which is very high, there must be an aluminum-rich component in the soil that we do not see in the type A and B rocks.
The three elements which I presented data on, together with Dr. Baedeker, were trace elements, gallium, germanium, and indium. These were determined by neutron activation. The gallium concentrations on the moon were distinctly different from those of other basaltic materials which one could compare the lunar rocks with, namely the basaltic achondrites and basaltic rocks on the Earth. Gallium was a good factor of 3 higher in the lunar materials and quite constant than in the basaltic achondrites. It was about a factor of 4 lower than in basaltic rocks. So this seems to be, again, as evidence presented by other people, it seems to be quite clear-cut that we're dealing with different rocks here, but just how different is not certain. Perhaps the parent magma was something resembling the basaltic achondrites, as Dr. Philpotts will probably mention in his summary. Germanium is an element which is in the primitive meteorites, and the chondritic meteorites is concentrated heavily in the metal phase. It's not present as an oxide, but rather mainly as reduced metal. And such elements tend to be reduced in the tend to be very low in concentration in lunar materials, and this is what we also found in the crystalline rocks from the moon. We found somewhat higher concentrations in the lunar fine material, the dust, and this is probably to be attributed to a mixing in of chondritic meteorite material, especially material resembling type 1 carbonaceous chondrites. Probably represents an admixture of about 1% of cosmic dust. Comparing the germanium to terrestrial rocks, it's much lower in the lunar materials, in all the lunar materials, than in terrestrial rocks, and it's about the same as in basaltic achondrites. One can't use germanium as a reason not to say that the basaltic achondrites are similar to the lunar rocks. Indium is a story completely different. It's a sad story. The indium concentrations that we found were actually reasonably high and relatively comparable and to some degree to terrestrial indium values. However, some were extremely high. Now, on the rock boxes, there was an indium seal around the top. And it's some of our values were so high, 100 or 10 times higher in the fine material than in any terrestrial rock or than the most indium-rich meteorite that's known. This almost certainly represents contamination. And if these that were a factor of 10 higher were contaminated, we have to be suspicious of all our data, and therefore we can only conclude that contamination was present and say nothing really about logical comparisons on indium.
Right. We determined concentrations of rare earth elements, potassium, rubidium, strontium, and barium. In some rocks in separated phases. The first conclusion is that these rocks represent a volcanic sequence similar in many respects to that found in dredge samples from the floor of the Earth's oceans. The lunar samples show significant differences in the elements that we analyze from the most common type of meteorite, the chondrites. There are also significant differences when you compare them to the crust, compare the lunar samples to crust of the Earth, continental crust that is, or with tektites, which again are quite different. On the other hand, there are many similarities between these lunar samples and the trace elements we studied with the achondritic meteorites and with the bulk Earth. There's probably a community of origin between these last three types of sample.
I guess that leads me to bring up the Vanguard. We are also playing this numbers game. We analyzed for about 30 elements by instrumental neutron activation techniques, which leave the samples intact so that they can be studied by other people after we learn something about their composition. And we've obtained somewhat over 1,000 pieces of data on the samples that we got, which means that it is my responsibility at a meeting like this to try to coalesce that data and winnow it down to a few rather limited conclusions. In this morning's session, as I think my colleagues on this panel will gladly agree, I may have gone slightly overboard on that task and indulged in what, if I were talking about terrestrial rocks, would be called geopoetry, but in this context is, I think, better called selenopoetry, and got rather speculative. Among the speculations that I tossed out were that the moon has always been very dry, and that if it indeed is very dry from the kinds of chemical evidence that we are just beginning to feel our way toward and has always been that way, then just as a for instance, there's no point in looking for permafrost layers up there, and if NASA wants to put a permanent base on the moon, they'd better cart all the water up on their backs because they aren't going to find any. That's an interesting quasi-conclusion, quasi because it is selenopoetic. Another thought that occurs to me upon listening to some of the comments that my colleagues have made is that we perhaps should emphasize rather strongly the difference between the type C and D rocks, the breccias, and what I still persist in calling soil, in quotation marks on the one hand, and the igneous rocks, the basalts and microgabbros, both of those in quotation marks on the other hand. There are many chemical differences between them, and you cannot make the soil simply by grinding up the igneous rocks we see. There has to be an admixture of some foreign material. I would like to suggest for your consideration that perhaps that foreign material is the highlands, and that perhaps, in a sense, we are already seeing some of the chemistry of the highlands in the material we have from Apollo 11, and perhaps even more clearly in some of the material we will get our hands on from Apollo 12. This, in a way, is a very encouraging conclusion. It means, on the one hand, that the materials we are picking up are very diverse, so that one sampling site gives us information about much more than simply the ground over which the astronauts walk. On the other hand, it means that our techniques, both simply technical and interpretive, conceptual, for sorting these things out are precise enough and finely honed enough so that we have a chance of figuring out which goes where. And I think that one is entitled to be rather encouraged by these two conclusions, because it means that it will be possible to learn quite a bit more about the moon than in my somewhat cynical way I had thought would be possible on the basis of a rather limited number of excursions to the lunar surface. Maybe perhaps we'd better throw it to general discussion.
Okay, we're ready now for questions. Please raise your hands, wait for the mics, and whenever possible, identify the specific individual that you're directing the question to. So help us with the transcript. Mark Kramer. And
Dr. Goles, what method do you propose for the movement of soil or whatever from the highland areas into the Maria?
That's not my bag. Well, okay. In other words, what selenopoetic comments do I have on that? Yeah. I think that Gene Shoemaker probably has the right idea there, that we're seeing the effects of material being bounced around by impacts. The impact history on the moon is rather clearly written in the surface features of the rocks that we're getting back, as well as in the photographs of lunar morphology on a somewhat larger scale. And it seems to me that there is rather good reason to believe that these are effective processes, micrometeorite and larger impacts for moving pieces of material around on the moon. I think it's fair to state that the degree of contamination of the lunar soil that I suggested has occurred with highland material need not have been very extensive in order for us to identify it, to pick it up. And you don't have to talk about transporting large masses of material from the highlands down into Mare Tranquillitatis. Even a little bit is detectable, just as even 1% of chondritic meteorite contamination is detectable. This is another thing that we all seem to be agreeing upon, that number is about 1%.
Question for Dr. Watson. If there was an indium contamination from the seal on the rock boxes, would this not also account for some of the high concentration of aluminum in some of the lighter samples that Dr. Morrison, I think, spoke of? And the other question is, would the other speakers like to speculate just very briefly on the significance of their own findings?
Dr. Eamon had specifically mentioned the high aluminum contents of the finds. This I don't believe this can be accounted for either by contamination nor by chondritic material. Maybe you'd like to say something about this.
Well, aluminum is a major element. With indium, you're talking about a trace element. It doesn't take much to give you a serious difference. Aluminum is a major element running in the soils up to 7.2% of the element aluminum. It would take a massive contamination to alter those data. It's just not reasonable. Indium, quite a different question, trace element.
Yeah, you'd see the aluminum alloys.
Right. You can see it.
Can I just say one point? We've been hearing a lot of numbers at this conference. Everybody has come with a full complement of numbers on a variety of elements. I think one must be very careful. This is my analytical training coming in, but we've had previous experience with geochemists analyzing known materials like standards and getting fantastic differently numbers. So what I'm suggesting is that I think there's going to be a period where we're going to have to sift down these numbers and come to a hardcore list before some of these interpretations can be fully explored.
Mark, I think all of us would be interested in
the speculation. Do you care to make them?
Speculations with regard to what?
With regard to your own data, your own.
Well, I think I have made them already, yes.
I think it must be recognized that several of my colleagues are much more cautious than I am. I stick my neck out much further than they do.
Right. I think I would be inclined to comment that there is very little in the particular kinds of information that we have gotten that we understand well enough in terrestrial systems to cause me to want to go along with any of the speculations that Dr. Goles here has been making on the same kind of information. I guess I'm playing conservative straight man, but somebody around here should be a little honest, don't you think?
I am honest. I'm saying exactly what I think.
I'm worried about your comment about dry magmas, Gordon. I just don't see how we have enough data to say whether the magmas were dry or wet.
Let's see, why don't we take Mark Bloom? He's been with us for a good while.
Dr. Watson, I was just wondering how you found out that there was an indium seal on that box. And
they told us well in advance that there was an indium seal. Many of us have determined indium. There's about 4 or 5 different research groups working on indium, and we all knew in advance that it was a danger. And some were pessimistic. I was optimistic. I thought, well, it'll all come out okay. But my optimism didn't pay off this time.
Why didn't you mildly request NASA that they find another seal?
Well, we did, but the thing is that you always have to play off one experiment versus another. And indium seemed to be the single best type of material to give a good vacuum seal, the safest type of seal. In fact, some of the boxes still didn't seal, even with the indium, but some of them did. And I think in the future we'll probably be able to get away from indium, at least on some of the boxes, because there are relatively few experiments that can't get along with the quality of seal that Teflon, for example, would give. And I certainly hope now that we see how bad the indium data on this first, on the Apollo 11 samples are, that steps will be taken to bring back indium uncontaminated samples from future missions. Because indium is a very volatile element. It's a very important element in the meteorites for telling us what's going on. And it's one that we would all like to see good numbers on, if possible.
Gentleman back there.
Dr. Gold, what kind of material do you attribute from your analysis to the highlands, poetically or otherwise?
Very poetically, I expect to find, at least somewhere in the highlands, once they're explored enough, calcium-rich achondrites. And I think we have already seen some fragments, some clasts in the breccias and in the coarse fraction of the lunar soil from 11, which are suggestive that there are plagioclase-rich rocks up there, which, while not exactly like calcium-rich achondrites, do tend to resemble them a little bit. Another way of putting this is that we may already have in the museums of Earth something like 30 or 40 individual samples of the lunar highlands.
Carl Abraham.
Dr. Philpotts, would you talk about the potassium results that you got and whether they're higher or lower than terrestrial rocks, and what, if anything, you might conclude from that?
All right. They're lower than almost all terrestrial rocks of similar major element composition. There are peridotites and ultramafic rocks on Earth that are as low or lower. The only basaltic rock on Earth that is as low in potassium as these lunar samples are these dredge basalts from the oceans. That's one of the points of similarity between the lunar samples and these dredge basalts.
Harry Page,
does that mean anything?
Well, one element by itself isn't awfully significant. You know, I'd prefer to talk about the ratios between this element and others.
What would it mean if rocks on the moon in general were depleted in potassium with respect to Earth, in comparison to Earth rocks?
Well, in general, they are. If you take the bulk major element chemistry of these lunar samples, you come up with essentially a basaltic composition. Most terrestrial basalts have higher potassium than these samples. The low potassium basalts that you find in the ocean are comparable, somewhat lower.
Harry Pease.
I'd like to crowd you, Dr. Haskin, and you, Dr. Philpott, toward this brink that you shied away from. If these rocks that you have examined do bear close resemblances to the seafloor basalts, does this imply a similar evolutionary history and similar processes at work in the moon and here on Earth? And what are the processes that would have to be similar?
I think that's exactly how I would interpret it, that we are not implying by the similarity for these elements a direct genetic relationship between the Earth and the Pacific Ocean Basin, although we are not refuting it either. It seems to me that the kinds of volcanic processes which have produced these rather similar crystalline rock types have perhaps had sufficiently similar chemical processing associated with them to derive for us similar relative abundances of these rare earth elements from a starting material which, if traced far enough back, may be a common starting material for both the Earth and the Moon. My own approach to this has been to examine particular processes which in general we know occur in silicate liquids, these being the formation of crystals which then settle out from the liquid. Or if we wish to generate the liquid in another way, we can begin with a solid material and melt part of it. And a good bit of our work now in our labs is trying to determine the relative importances of these particular processes for producing the different kinds of changes in rare earth behavior that we find in different basalts. And we are simply not to the stage yet where we really understand very much about what causes the changes in the ratios among these elements.
I have two brief questions. Dr. Amon, would you repeat that figure that you gave on the content of the aluminum? I just I didn't get that down quite right.
In the lunar soil, 7.2% of the element aluminum. It's got a lot of aluminum, yes. Now, the highest, the breccias are the next highest as a group. They run around, as I recall, the number 6.6%. And then going on down, the type A, the fine-grained rocks, had the lowest aluminum content of the order of 4%, 4.5% aluminum. And the groups are quite distinct, except that the soils and the breccias were quite similar in their aluminum content.
For Dr. Goles, the conclusion of your paper, you say it is clear these rocks have been subjected to complex and unusual differentiation processes. Would you indulge in a little geopoetry on that?
Selenopoetry. Well, I think as soon as... Let me go back a little bit in history. When I first saw Tony Turkovich's estimates from the Surveyor 5 instrument package, I thought he had inadvertently analyzed a titanium alloy along with his lunar surface sample. I should have known better because Tony almost never makes a mistake. He's a very cautious gentleman, a very, very fine chemist. And in fact, his results were completely and very precisely confirmed by the results of the preliminary examination team done here at Houston on the Apollo 11 material. From that time on, it was clear that we were faced with a very intriguing problem in geochemistry because we had materials to deal with which had bulk compositions totally unlike anything we had ever worked with before. I think that that statement is not a selenopoetical statement. It is a simple statement of fact. And the divergence between what we were used to was so great that we are only perhaps just beginning to recover from the sort of cultural shock induced by having to work with these very peculiar materials. Now, that in itself, I think, says right away that something funny is going on. And the evidence that we are now seeing coming out of the very fine work that has been done by my colleagues here on the panel and others on trace elements only serves to confirm this. It is true that there are terrestrial samples, notably the abyssal basalts erupted at the mid-oceanic ridges and rises, which in many ways resemble the Apollo 11 materials. It is also true that there are some rather strong and striking divergences in chemical composition. So while we are beginning to get a feel for this, beginning to get a handle on it, we are clearly dealing with a very odd breed of cats, any way you cut it. And the comparisons that we can make are going to be very limited in scope.
Do you have a model?
Dr. Goles, you said that you think that the moon may always have been a very dry place. If that's the case, if there never was much presence of water, could that account for the differences that you see that you've just been discussing?
In part, I think not completely, I would be very hard put, at this time at least, even with my somewhat speculative bent, to defend a statement that the high titanium and iron content of the Apollo 11 rocks is directly related to the dryness of the moon. It might be in some very roundabout way, but I don't think I can really say anything about that at present. Let me emphasize that there is, in a way, sort of independent evidence for the truth of this statement, no matter what some of my more cautious colleagues may think about it, in that the closest correspondences we find on Earth, the abyssal basalts erupted at the mid-oceanic ridges and rises, almost certainly from rather good geophysical data and petrological models of the upper mantle, are also coming from areas of the mantle that are quite dry. There's some argument about this back and forth, but I don't think anybody will argue that they're drier in the areas of the mantle where a big chunk of the crust is being dragged down into the mantle and carrying lots of water with it in the sediments and is sort of soaking the whole thing in water. And we see a very different kind of geochemistry in the products of eruption of volcanoes that are built over such parts of the crust. So I think even on the Earth, there is some support for this point of view. It has to be interpreted perhaps with a broad brush at present because we don't have the fine brushes to fill in the fine details, but there is some support for that point.
I'd like to interject a point there that probably more than the water, I would think the shallow depth of differentiation, or at least the low pressure, would be more significant.
That may well be, John, but I'm hard put to see how, for instance, that changes the relationship between zirconium and hafnium.
Yeah, no, true, but it's just the fact that certain minerals are stable under given pressure, and the dredged basalts are certainly low-pressure rocks, and on the moon you expect these pressures to go down to greater depth because of the smaller mass. This is a partial explanation, I think, of the similarity between these lunar rocks and the dredged basalts, that they're both low-pressure differentiation products.
Maybe I should also comment that these divergencies of interpretation are susceptible to rather direct experimental proof. And if we can just get a year or two off in our laboratories quietly away from interruptions, we can sort it out. Not that that is likely to happen.
Okay, we're rounding up the other panel now, so we've got time for about two more questions. Let's take Dick Lewis, and then Earl Ubel has had his hand up for a good while.
I have two short questions, one for Dr. Goles and one for the panel. Are you assuming that no hydrated materials will be found anywhere on the moon in your assumption that there was never any water?
I think it's incorrect to say that that's an assumption. That's a very speculative conclusion from very uncertain interpretations. But it is perhaps a warning of what we might expect to find.
You would say then that this is an indication rather than a conclusion?
Oh, yes, by all means.
Second question I'd like to ask the panel is this. Has there been enough time since you received the materials from the Lunar Receiving Laboratory, has there been enough time to really conduct your work adequately? If there has been on this flight, would you like to have more time? In other words, is the stretch out that NASA plans between the flights going to be an advantage for this kind of detailed work?
Might I ask all on the panel who agree that there has not been enough time to raise their hands?
Well, let me just qualify it a little.
Yeah, okay.
Let me say that I've never seen such intensity of dedication in my years of teaching. I visited a number of laboratories around the country, and wherever there was a lunar group, you could get a seminar up at the drop of a hat, and whether it be Saturday afternoon or Sunday or evenings. The danger of spreading it out, I think, is the fact that at least at the universities, we have graduate students and postdocs who are there for a limited time, and they really are a honed team. And were this to be spread out beyond, too long a time, we would have the problem of training new people and starting all over again.
I think the new proposal, I believe two flights a year, sounds quite reasonable to me personally. I think all of us put in some mighty long hours, and over the Christmas holidays, didn't see much of the family and that sort of thing. But that's true of everybody here, and it was very exciting to be part of it. I think the new proposal, though, of two flights a year, is quite a reasonable one.
Hey, let's take our last question from Earl Ubel. We've got the other people standing by us.
I've heard the
lots of things about many different elements. Some are enriched and some are depleted and so on. And I've kind of lost track. I wonder if you could just quickly tick off for me the ones which, in which lunar soils and rocks are enriched relative to those of the Earth and which are depleted.
I regret to say that I've lost track, too. Maybe Dr. Morrison, who has a very good memory for these things and analyzed 60-some samples, can answer that
maybe
question.
Maybe I can even find it in my notes. But as I recall, elements such as the rare earths, titanium, zirconium, hafnium, perhaps yttrium, are enriched. These are the so-called refractory elements, high boilers. The volatile elements appear to be depleted, or some of the volatile elements, those that boil easily.
Yeah, the alkalis in general.
The alkalis, zinc, copper, things like that.
Indium, antimony.
Indium, maybe.
Selenium. Well, we've got some aluminum.
Aluminum, oxygen, nitrogen.
Well, oxygen is somewhat low, as I said earlier. In the lunar rocks.
It would be hard to distinguish those from just sort of normal petrological things, you know. We're now getting into the range of variation of rock suites that we're acquainted with on the Earth. And they don't stand out clearly like some of these other things that Professor Morrison mentioned.
The major elements like aluminum, iron, nickel, what do they look like?
They're not way out in left field or anything like that, no.
Well, the high titanium and iron and the low alkalis is a striking feature of the major element
major
chemistry. Right.
That's the story there.
Right, and that's the story we knew when Tony Turkovich's results came out.
Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen. We will start our second session very briefly.
I don't know if you were there for mine, but I said that there's a hierarchy.
That's
the confidence hierarchy are the problems that are involved with the interaction with the surface, with its environment, with the meteorite impact. Down from that, you've got the question,
well,
what
warm
are the magnets as they are erupted and crystallized?
Oh, I'll say that.
How do they crystallize?
Okay.
Down one level from that, how do these magnets originate? I think we were discussing.
Hey, I don't.
Okay, we're ready to start now with our solar wind session. The gentleman furthest on my right is Dr. Fleischer. We'll start with Dr. Fleischer and have Dr. Fleischer describe in approximately 2 minutes the substance of his talk. And if we can have each of the gentlemen to Dr. Fleischer's left follow the same procedure by prefacing it with an introduction of their name and affiliation, we would appreciate it. And then we'll open it for questions.
The work we've been concerned with primarily has to do with particle tracks and what they allow us to do in the way of inferring what radiation has been incident on the surface of the moon, and also to learn about the movement of rocks and soil on the lunar surface. The primary particle that we're making use of are heavy cosmic ray particles, usually iron group nuclei, which leave tracks in natural minerals, those that are insulating minerals. And these tracks we can show up by chemical etching, eating tiny holes along these tracks, and we can count them and say how many cosmic rays stopped at a given place in, let's say, a rock. So we can trace out from one surface to another how many cosmic rays stop there. And on the upper surface of a rock, more cosmic rays will stop. We'll have high track densities there and fewer towards the interior. And, for example, on one of the rocks that a great many of the workers here have studied, rock 17, we find a high track density at the top surface, decreasing towards the interior, and then rising again towards what was the bottom surface on the moon. And this tells us very clearly that this was turned over. From looking at the number of tracks there, we can say how long it was sitting up there. And this is, as lunar times go, a short time, 4 million years, while some of the other gentlemen here have measured times like 500 million years. And so we infer that although this was on the surface and was turned over at least once while it was there, during a long period of time, it was in the top surface layers but covered up by at least 15 centimeters of soil. And we can look at soil from the core. Again, we ought to find a lot of tracks at the top and fewer towards the interior. Instead, we find a totally chaotic distribution. Many tracks in some particles, few in others, and it has no correlation with whether they're top or bottom. And so this, again, is evidence that the soil's been turned up, turned over many times. And the sort of number that we quote there, if it's just a matter of stirring of the soil, is something like every 15,000 years the soil is stirred around. The other thing of, two things of some interest. One, we have evidence of very short-range particles from the sun that are probably very heavy solar wind particles, something of a mass comparable to that of a lead atom. We have measurements of cosmic rays, which are most likely solar particles and very low energies, and we can say that there is a component there that is in abundance quite comparable with those that you find in what's usually called an intermediate energy range, which is 50 to 300 MeV per nucleon.
In addition to Dr. Fleisch's comments, I might add that we have done similar studies. Okay. Yeah. My name is Kurt Marti. Marti, M-A-R-T-I. We have done similar studies using stable isotopes of noble gases and combining stable isotope anomalies produced by cosmic rays with current concentrations of radioisotopes like krypton 81. We can determine, as Dr. Fleischer mentioned already, cosmic ray exposure ages of the rocks and the soil. These cosmic ray exposure ages, determined by the so-called krypton-krypton method, come out to lie in a region between 50 and 500 million years, clearly much higher than the ages obtained by the direct dating method. Furthermore, we find variations in the relative production of the stable isotopes of krypton and xenon. In the xenon isotopes, this variation between, for instance, the isotopes 126 and 131 is a factor of 2, and this can only explain by a varying irradiation condition or varying irradiation conditions, changing energy spectrum. And again, this leads us to conclude that the rocks and the soil have been turned over, have been positioned different depths. At high depth, the irradiation spectrum is soft, and therefore you get different relative production rates as in the case when the rock is lying on the surface. So these results from the stable isotope studies agree pretty much with the conclusions that the people have been obtained using track dating methods, track work.
I'm Bob Pepin, University of Minnesota, and I'm primarily interested not in the spallation effects, but in the isotopic composition of the noble gases on which these spallation gases have been added. Now, Dr. Marti is also very interested in this, and he's very kindly left part of this subject to me. Our knowledge before the lunar samples were returned was based entirely on meteorites that we've all been looking at for a number of years, and on heavy noble gases in the atmosphere of the Earth. And it became clear about 10 years ago that we had very great differences in the isotopic compositions of these so-called trap gases, spallation-free. We're not worrying about spallation now or cosmic ray effects. Very great differences between the Earth and the meteorites in xenon, and very little difference in krypton. So it was very interesting to take a look at the isotopic compositions of these so-called trap gases underlying the irradiation gases in the lunar samples, and to a first approximation, they look meteoritic. So from this point of view alone, we can say that the history of genesis of the rare gases in the lunar samples is much more meteoritic than it is terrestrial. The terrestrial rare gases, the Earth's rare gases, are so far anomalous, not only compared to the meteorites, but now compared to the moon. And in fact, the points of similarity between the rare gases in the meteorites and in the moon are really quite striking, and as is natural in a situation like this, we concentrate on the differences, but the point should be made that in many respects, they are startlingly the same. One of the differences I'd like to point out is that for a number of years, we have been looking very critically at the isotopic composition of both krypton and xenon in meteorites, and have found there a heavy rare gas component which appears to be due to the fission of a completely unknown parent nuclide. We have absolutely no idea what has happened in the solar system to produce this very strange gas. We find that in the lunar material and in some of the gas-rich meteorites that Dr. Marty has looked at, the abundance of this component is very much diminished relative to the meteorites. And I think this is probably a fairly powerful clue in our long effort to delineate a source for this component. And some of the possible sources are really quite interesting. It has been suggested that we may be looking at fission products from one of the very heavy islands of stability in the mass table up around mass 300, which has so far not been detected, but may have existed in nature. That is a theory which is due in large part to Professor Hyman, the third gentleman on my left. Another possibility is that we're looking at an effect which is actually due to a supernova stage of element synthesis before the solar system began, and that, in fact, this anomalous material was carried into the early primitive solar system dust gas cloud by an expanding debris wave from a supernova. This is all very speculative, but it's a component for which, at the moment, we have really no very good ideas. And I think the lunar samples are going to be important in untangling the origin of this.
I'm Oliver Schaefer from State University of New York at Stony Brook. Our studies have been mainly concerned with rare gases in meteorites, and let me just dwell on the types of ages that we've obtained in this way. We've obtained radiation ages, that is the length of time that particular rock lay on the surface of the moon. It'd be the time between some meteorite impact that produced a small crater or a large crater, threw out a piece of rock, and then it lay there, presumably undisturbed, until it was brought back by the astronauts. And we find, at Tranquility Base, we find ages that run from a few million years up to about 400 or 500 million years. We found at our preliminary investigations at the Apollo 12 site, we found ages that were about half that. It would look as though that site, that surface, if you interpret it the way Dr. Shoemaker did, was of younger surface on that basis. We've also measured the potassium-argon age, which is the age at which the rock crystallized, at which it was molten, and then it became a solid rock as we found it today. So that's naturally an older event, because the meteorite threw out the crystalline rock. And those ages at Tranquility Base were varied from about 2.5 billion years up to 3.8 billion years. And we've been very happy that the rubidium strontium and the lead ages agree with our potassium argon highest values, which would be the most reliable one, of around 3.8 plus or minus 0.2 billion years. At the Apollo 12 site, we found that the rocks varied in age younger than that, and they varied from about 2 billion up to a highest value of 2.8 billion years. This would indicate that the mechanism for forming maria on the lunar surface is extended to a time of only 2.4 billion years ago. So if the moon is 4.6 billion years old, like the Earth, that would indicate that there was maria formation on the surface of the moon for a 2 billion year period.
My name is Joe Zahringer, Z-A-H-R-I-N-G-E-R, Max Planck Institute in Heidelberg, Germany. We have used a very sensitive micro helium probe to study the rare gases in single grains. We selected 800 grains and separated them in ilmenite, titanium-rich glass, pyroxene, and plagioglass, and we found these solar wind gases are concentrated in the very outer surface layer, and they are by heating on the lunar surface, they penetrate into this grain about 10 microns. The helium goes in about 10 microns. There are variations within the same type of minerals by a factor of 10, or some have no detectable helium. That means some grains have not been on the surface, some have been. From the penetration of this helium, you can calculate the time they have been lying on the surface, and that's about 10,000 years. When you take off the surface layers, the solar wind layers, the spallogenic and radiogenic gases show up, and this way we could estimate the age of the lunar soil. And the radiation age, exposure age, is 500 million years. The radiogenic age we estimate to 3.5 billion years, again high, as found by other investigators. The whole studies were made with 1 milligram of sample. We saved a lot of money for the U.S. government.
I'm Dieter Heymann, H-E-Y-M-A-N-N, from Rice University, and I'm the fifth person in this row now who has been studying rare gases in the lunar soil. I hope you gentlemen do not conclude from this that NASA thinks we are sloppy workers that need checking one another. During our work, we got interested in one puzzle that had already been uncovered by the preliminary examination team in August, September of this year. And that puzzle, briefly, is this. The amount of argon-40 that is found in the soil could be derived from various sources, but the most obvious and direct one would be from the radioactive decay of potassium in the soil. Now, you can take the potassium content that was also determined in the preliminary investigation and then simply calculate this age, and you get an embarrassingly high value, something like 7 or 8 billion years. And none of us was willing to accept this value, and so we got quite intrigued in our work. This was one facet of our work with this problem. We studied the argon-40 in a number of grain size fractions of the soil. That is, we took out fractions of different sizes. And when we plotted, which do not only contain argon-40, which also contain another isotope, argon-36, which we do know comes from the solar wind. And when we make this plot, we found a very striking correlation, namely that all the points lie on a straight line. The straight line tells us two things. A, that where it intercepts the argon-40 axis, that is, where there is no more argon-36 from the solar wind present, that there is still a little bit of argon-40 left. We have interpreted this amount of argon-40 as the genuine radiogenic argon from potassium decay. And if we now take the amount of potassium and do the same calculation, the age fortunately goes down and turns out to be 4.1 billion years. It is interesting, again, that to see that this potassium-argon age of 4.1 billion years for the soil is higher, generally speaking, than the same kinds of ages that were measured in the rocks by various investigators, a thing you have probably heard yesterday for the other kinds of ages, rubidium, strontium, and lead-lead ages. So again, the potassium-argon age indicates the same sort of thing, as if this, it looks as if the soil is older than the rocks, and that is a major puzzle. The other thing we found now was that the large amount of argon-40, which is on that straight line, which gives a constant ratio to argon-36, must have come through the surface of the fragments in the lunar soil. It must have come from the outside and gone through the surface in there. Now, If you want to let that come from the sun, you make some of my colleagues unhappy who say there cannot be that much argon-40 in the sun. One of them has even threatened to resign his position at Rice University. So we had to look for something else.
Don't give his name. No. Have to keep his promise.
Okay. We speculated that the moon itself would be the best environment to make this argon-40 from potassium decay in the moon. And all you have to do is either heat the moon up a little bit, you don't have to melt it completely, or melt it locally at the surface so that argon-40, which now was formed in the moon, is released into the lunar atmosphere and can then get trapped into these fragments by some mechanism. We do not really know exactly what that mechanism is. We have speculated that there has been in the past a tenuous atmosphere on the moon, that this atmosphere was bombarded by the same cosmic rays as all these gentlemen have been talking about, and that some of the argon-40 was now knocked back like a billiard ball into the surface. Professor Gold, who was present at the conference, at the meeting, suggested another intriguing possibility, namely that the argon really vaporizes, escapes from the moon, gets ionized, and now is swept up by the solar wind and carried back into the moon and deposited there.
Okay. My name's Ed Fireman. I'm at the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I measured tritium, it's a radioactive hydrogen, and some radioactive argon in some samples, soil and rocks were given to me. And actually, I've been doing this sort of thing for about 17 or 18 years. On meteorites, actually, we found tritium in meteorites about 17 years ago and argon maybe about 15 years ago, and we interpret these radioactivities as being due to cosmic ray bombardment of these bodies which are out in space, so that I, in a sense, could have told them they would have found radioactivities in comparable amounts on the lunar surface 17 years ago, and that's what they're finding. And I'd say about 10 years ago, we measured radioactivities in satellites that were recovered. We even did radioactivities in Russian satellite that landed in Wisconsin, Sputnik 4. And some of our Discoverer satellites. And there we saw effects not only of cosmic rays, which we saw deep down in meteorites, but satellites didn't have too much protective cover. And so we saw effects due to the sun's bombardment on these satellites. So about 8 or 9 years ago, I would have said, you also see solar proton bombardments on these stuff sitting on the sun. And when these samples came to me, I said, well, I'm all set up to do these other things. I know smack just how much to expect of all solar protons, roughly, and how much cosmic rays. Build equipment of a certain size to get ready for this, and when they'll give me the sample, I'll be done in this certain size range. And if I'm lucky, I'll check out all these results. And I was lucky. They gave me samples in the size range I was prepared for. We got the numbers, and they came out just smack. Well, was it very close to what I anticipated. And I guess that's true for the cosmic ray radioactivities that were reported yesterday. Within a factor of two, they came out within the results I would have predicted, and others would have predicted on the basis of meteorite results and recovered satellite results. So that I haven't been shocked by anything that's been said, and perhaps I should be delighted that there were no shocking surprises in the radioactivities on the lunar samples, and that our early results were so close to being right. Does that cover it? Doesn't make any excitement, but that's the way I feel.
I'm Richard Perkins from Battelle Northwest Laboratories in Richland, Washington.
we've been doing a rather unique type of work, measuring rather the noble gases, some of which are radioactive, some of the cosmic ray produced non-gaseous radionuclides in the lunar samples, and also some of the primordial radionuclides which are in the lunar samples. Now, measurements of these tell you something about processes that have been occurring on the Sun as well as processes that have been occurring on the Moon. The Sun emits cosmic rays which produce radioactivity in the surface of the Moon. Also, we have galactic cosmic rays from deep in our galaxy that penetrate the surface of the Moon and produce radioactivity there. The radioactivities that we are measuring, we're dealing with measuring radionuclides that have half-lives all the way from about 16 days to about 750,000 years. So we're able to measure processes that take place on these time scales. With a longer-lived cosmogenic radionuclide that we made measurements on was aluminum-26 with a 750,000-year half-life. The concentrations that are present indicate that the rocks and the dust have been exposed there a very long time. One of the interesting observations was that the dust had a good deal more of this aluminum-26 in than the fines. This would suggest that the dust samples that were taken at a rather shallow depth, and that they must have remained there at a shallow depth for a long time compared with the half-life of aluminum-26, which means they must have remained there for millions of years. Another observation that it was possible to make is what the relative contribution of galactic and cosmic rays to radionuclide production on the lunar surface was. By comparing aluminum-26 concentrations in the lunar surface with those in the meteorite, we were able to establish that the lunar fine radionuclide production from solar cosmic rays was probably about four times that from galactic cosmic rays. Of course, the solar cosmic ray production is in spikes, that is, it's associated with directly with solar flares. One of the other types of measurements we were making were primordial radionuclides. And I might mention that all of these are non-destructive measurements. I suppose we had one of the largest samples for these that NASA dispersed for our dust sample. We used a full kilogram sample. Of course, we didn't ever open the container, didn't damage the sample. It's safe and ready for further investigations as it was when we received it. We're simply measuring the gamma radiation that is emitted by these types of samples. I was going to go on to mention the primordial radionuclides, more commonly called natural radioactivity here on Earth, potassium, uranium, and thorium. One of the interesting observations we made on this was a high degree of constancy of the thorium to uranium ratio. This comes out to be 3.8 with a fairly narrow plus or minus value. This means that thorium and uranium have behaved chemically very similarly on the Moon. This might be expected. The chemistry of the two in the reduced state, that is the plus 4 state, is very similar. They have similar ionic radii. They have essentially identical outer electron configurations. And they evidently have behaved the same. This ratio of 3.8, it's interesting to compare this with what was predicted for the uranium-thorium ratio, present-day uranium-thorium ratio, from a continuous nucleosynthesis of the elements that started some 11.6 million years ago, and our solar system was removed from it some 4.7 million years ago. This was a theory put forth not by ourselves, but by some others, Fowler and Hoyle, some 10 years ago now.
Okay, we're ready now for questions. Please raise your hands and wait for the mics. John Wilford.
Dr. Heyman, on this argon-40, I'm not sure how, according to your theory, how did the Moon produce argon-40 in the amounts that you're dealing with? And do you have any theories as to what this atmosphere was made of?
The mode of production was in the Moon itself, in its interior, both in its interior and at the surface, which contains potassium. Of course, initially when the Moon was formed, there wasn't much argon-40 around, because I do not believe that the Moon ever had an extensive atmosphere. But then, after the moon was formed, this potassium decay led to accumulation of argon-40 in its interior. Now, the amounts of argon that we see in the soil are, of course, quite high, but on the other hand, the weight of the soil compared to the weight of the total moon is probably very low. And from that, you can see that it does not really need much outgassing of the moon to put the amounts of argon into the soil that we're seeing. We have not really made an extensive calculation of this, but I do believe it's fair to say that a just moderate, maybe even only a very minor heating of the whole moon would be required. And the other possible thing, the other possible mechanism you can rely on or you can revert to is that an impact such as made Mare Imbrium in lunar rocks, which were by that time already on the moon as we know now for about a billion or half a billion years or maybe even longer, would also release an appreciable amount of argon. Now, to the second part of your question, the gas released would not be argon alone, of course. There would be other gases in this tenuous atmosphere. There could have been the other inert gases, helium, neon, krypton and xenon, and possibly hydrogen and nitrogen, and what have you. What interests us is really, the only thing we need really is that the argon-40 to argon-36 in that atmosphere must be higher than what we expect it to be in the sun. Now, this is not such a surprise because, after all, in our atmosphere, the argon-40 to argon-36 ratio is very high. It's about 300. And the reason for that is basically the same that I'm giving you for the moon. In our, on the Earth, the large amount of argon-40 in the atmosphere is due to potassium decay in the crust, which forms argon-40 and which is then released into the atmosphere. Does that answer your question?
Two points about cosmic rays. You said that most of the energies were in the medium range, but what sort of peak energies did you see? And secondly, does the exposure time that you calculate assume that the cosmic ray intensity has been uniform with time? And what evidence is there that this is in fact so?
Are you directing your question to a particular person?
Oh, I don't know who might answer this.
Your first question was energetic cosmic rays, if I remember. How high an energy does one get by the methods that we use looking at material on the lunar surface? We don't go to nearly as high energies as people who go deep underground on the Earth. In fact, if you want to go to determine the very high cosmic ray energies, you would go down to in a mine and not to the surface of the moon. If you're talking, because the very high energetic particles just traverse, are very scarce, but they penetrate a lot of material. The very low energy particles of cosmic rays are very plentiful, but they're absorbed on the top of our atmosphere. So what we have been studying here are, and get information about, are the low energy cosmic rays less than a billion volts, mainly, and these are energies even smaller than those that people make in accelerators. Am I trying to answer your question? We don't get any information from lunar studies about the very high energy particles. No one by 10 to the 15, 16, 17, 18 billion volt particles that people in cosmic rays have told us exist, that come from outside our galaxy and come from other galaxies. No one from any lunar study could tell you anything about such events, but people from other type of studies tell us a great deal about those events. So that would answer your first question. Now, your second question was, had to do with,
the cosmic ray intensity has been uniform.
Each one makes a different assumption. Yeah, each one usually says that this particular isotope has been produced at a constant rate.
Let's try it for John Lennon again. On the third row over here.
Dr. Heyman, I'm not altogether sure I understand this concentration effect. You, from what I gather, you get an argon released from a warm body such as the moon. It goes into a tenuous atmosphere, then is redeposited or accreted in some way in the surface layers. Is this what gives you the age difference between the basaltic composition and the overburden?
No. That gives me an explanation for, remember I mentioned we made this plot of argon 40 to argon 36, and we see two components in that. One is the radiogenic argon, which was, and I have to be very specific here, that radiogenic argon I'm speaking about that was that we see as a residue in the fines, that was formed in the fines themselves, from the potassium in the fines themselves, right there. Now, the argon 40 that we see in the other component, which gives this straight sloping line, that must have come from somewhere else. And because we know that it came, we do know that it came through the surfaces of the individual fragments in the soil. It came from the outside. It was not formed inside the fragments itself. Now, we have to look for a mechanism how to put it in there. And our speculation is that argon 40 from deeper in the moon was released by gentle heating, perhaps. And it was formed in the moon from potassium decay, you see, in the interior of the moon, or near the surface. We are not really bound to any specific place where that was formed, but we say on the moon or in the moon. Now it came into the atmosphere. Then we need a process to knock it back into the surfaces of the grains. And we favored a knocking in process whereby argon that is in this tenuous atmosphere is hit by cosmic ray protons, like two pool balls, you know, and the front ball is then goes then towards the surface with a certain energy, and when it strikes a fragment lying on the surface of the moon, gets implanted back into these fragments of the lunar soil.
But the significance of the data then is does not relate to the aging so much as it relates to the potentiality of a heating process.
Now, the significance perhaps lies in that this was a puzzle before, which puzzled us mightily, and that perhaps we have now a reasonable explanation for it.
We heard yesterday that there is a disparity in the neon isotope relationships. That is, that apparently the moon has a greater, heavier neon to a lighter neon than was anticipated. Does anybody, and I've been looking around for a meaning for that.
We had an explanation about it.
Yeah, I'd like to hear that.
The result of some conversations with Don Clayton at Rice, and it's really his idea. That is that on the surface of the moon, you implant this neon from solar wind, solar flares, from solar phenomenon, and you have associated with that a proton component. And there's a very high cross-section, a very probable reaction of protons reacting with sodium. Sodium happens to only have one isotope in nature. And it's a P-alpha, that is a proton goes in and an alpha particle or helium comes out to produce neon 20. And if you make a rough estimate as to the number of protons that you'd expect over the period of time that the soil has been irradiated, they use the radiation exposure ages, and look, the cross-section goes up to very high values because it gives off 2 MeV in the process. So you only have to have enough energy in the proton to penetrate the Coulomb barrier, the electrical repulsion between the sodium and the proton. And it comes out to be a reasonable sort of an estimate. Now, it has to be shored up by some good cross-section measurements to make sure that's the case, but that would then give you the kind of variability that you find in that ratio, because you wouldn't expect that to always be the same, and we find that in the neon isotopes, the 20 to 22 is much more variable than the others. Just the same way that this explanation of argon 40 is a 40 to 36 in argon is a very variable thing. So you have to, it's obviously two different mechanisms. I mean, that's what you would think, and so this other mechanism for the neon 20, which was suggested by Clayton at Rice, we feel, has a good chance of being the correct explanation for this process.
I thought the neon ratios were also rather peculiar in the foil, which the astronauts brought back, which makes it a little bit more difficult of an explanation, doesn't it?
I'm not sure about the foil.
That's actually a very good point. This is a very controversial matter. I don't know whether you intended to start such a controversy, but I do not believe this explanation.
Start the controversy.
I should have known. The problem is that these variable neon 2022 ratios are not restricted to the lunar material. And in fact, the range of neon 2022 ratios that one sees in the lunar material is duplicated almost exactly by the range of such values we see in a type of meteorite called the gas-rich meteorite. Now, it's suspected that the gas-rich meteorite may have formed in an environment similar to the lunar surface. So it, in fact, may have been irradiated, in fact, almost certainly was irradiated by the solar wind. But the problem is that we see meteorites that have very little of this component, as if they'd just been brushed by the solar wind. We see meteorites that have a great deal of it, up to within 10% of the amount that the lunar soil has. And the range of the 2022 ratios and their variability as we extract the gas from the meteorite seem not to vary at all. They're the same, no matter what the irradiation conditions that we can derive for the meteorite are, short irradiations, long irradiations. It would seem that, I would have to be convinced that there was a possibility of establishing a real correlation between the solar wind irradiation, which may implant these gases both in the meteorites and the lunar material, and the type of considerably higher energy proton flux which is required to initiate this nuclear reaction to make the neon 20 move around in abundance. And I am at the moment quite unconvinced. But there are experiments, which I think we probably ought to start thinking about doing, which could, in principle, decide this question.
What about the just one last question, I'll get off this. What about the examination of the surveyor exposed the surfaces? Wouldn't that give you a handle?
Lovely. Lovely. The only problem is getting the material.
Why can't you get it?
Well, right now it's not available for distribution. There is a bit of a flap about what was exactly going to happen to that material. It's not settled yet. And it'll be an internal NASA decision about whether it's distributed to the outside. And we'll wait.
Well, I don't understand that. I thought it was supposed to be distributed. No? Yes? What? Mm-hmm.
So far, permission to distribute it or an allocation plan for it has not been derived.
I think that it's clear from everything I've heard that there are proposals for the use of that material, and that NASA will make a careful survey of those proposals and select certain people to do certain things. The sort of things that that Bob Pepin and I would like to do are completely destructive of the material.
Yeah.
And there isn't very much material, and so there may be other more important things that should be done first. I mean, that would be reasonable.
No.
Because the things we want to do, we could do at any time, say, but no one can do what they want to do after after we're finished.
Well, I think it's also true that not all the suggestions have come in to them yet as to just what ought to be done with this material. For example, we have some use for some of the glass that appears in the television camera, which will have been irradiated by cosmic rays. And although they are clearly aware of our desire for this material, a formal request is just going to get to them in a few days. Tracks.
Yeah, I don't mean to suggest they're going to sit on this material, but there's no allocation plan yet, and it'll be delayed. It'll be February or March at least, I should think.
That's being optimistic.
What the foil experiment concerns, the results so far are preliminary, but they agree pretty well with the soil composition, I think.
For the neon?
For the neon, yeah. But they're not final. People are still working.
I wonder whether anyone on the panel, or perhaps Earl Ubel, might have a theory on why the dust on the moon appears to be older than the rocks.
Well, I heard a suggestion, and it's one that appealed to me. It may or may not be true, though. It was a suggestion that was rumored was started by Professor Ringwood of Australia. And he pointed out that in, say, making younger rocks, like if you get a rock that's 3.6 billion years old, that's younger than the age of the moon itself, which is 4.6, and if we make other maria that are still younger. In making these younger rocks, you always, in all of these isotopic dating methods, you differentiate the material, so you're starting to set the clock back. And that's been clear in potassium argon, because there, one's a gas. When you set the clock back, we find excess argon in the soil, which must come from that sort of a thing. So his suggestion was that maybe by some mechanism, which we haven't sort of thought of yet, we're really setting the clock back. That is, we're looking at the debris. We're looking at these enhanced things that really make things look old in the stuff on the surface of the moon, and that the rocks themselves have set the clock back. You know, if you set the clock back, you've got to pay. I mean, if you travel across the Atlantic a lot, you find out about that sort of thing. But it's that type of thing, and this may be this debris, which is Ringwood's idea, maybe what's making these things look older than they really are. No, well, just look at the potassium argon. That's the easiest one to see. All the others are very difficult to explain because the products are stable and there's a lot of chemistry that goes on. There's a lot of mineral differentiation. But in the potassium argon, which in principle is the same sort of thing, if you form the maria rocks, then you degas all the argon that was there before in the rock, which escapes. And apparently some of it is trapped in the lunar soil. That's why we see all this extra argon-40 in the soil. That's the argon-40 that's been trapped there. Well, now if you set back the clock on the other things, then some of the other isotopes may be located in the soil, in the soil for that reason. That's the
radiogenic argon of
Hayman.
You know, I'm sorry.
Yeah, let's go to one final quick question from McElhaney. We're getting ready to start the afternoon session.
Oh, okay. This is for Dr. Fleischer. You did mention an extremely, or several, I don't know whether it was just one, but extremely heavy nuclei, evidence of something as heavy as lead. What's the evidence for that, and also what would this imply? Does it imply anything brand new or surprising about processes in the sun?
No, it doesn't really. The statement, in essence, was we have some evidence which it is certainly not crystal clear, but what seems to me like the by far the most likely interpretation of it is that we have heavy particles coming from the sun at the solar wind velocities. Now, if you take a lead atom from the sun and put it at solar wind velocities, it will make a track in hitting a dielectric material that is somewhere in the range of 200 to 1,000 angstroms, a very short distance indeed. And we find high numbers of these tracks in a sample whose cosmic ray exposure time we know. And so we can make some estimate then of what the flux of these things from the sun is. And on that basis, you can estimate an abundance of these tracks relative to hydrogen. This comes out about 2 times 10 to the minus 11. And this is the same number that comes out for the abundance of lead in the sun. So if this picture holds up, it suggests that only atoms of a mass of the order of 200 and greater will leave tracks of this sort.
Thank you very much, Joe.